Brother August, if you'd read the 6th verse.
And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, The Son of Man, put forth a riddle, and speak a parable unto the house of Israel, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, A great eagle with great wings, long winged, full of feathers, which had divers colors, came unto Lebanon, and took the highest branch of the cedar. He cropped off the top of his young twigs, and carried it into a land of traffic. He set it in the city of merchants. He took also the seed of the land, and planted it in a fruitful field. He placed it by great waters, and set it as a willow tree, and grew and became a spreading vine of low stature, whose branches turned toward him, and the roots thereof were under him. So it became a vine, and brought forth branches, and shot forth sprigs.
I was thinking, I had said that we'd stop and consider it, but it might be better to see the setting of the whole parable, and then go back and consider the first 6 verses as a unit, and then the following. So we'll have more reading. That's one setting, one eagle is the predominant feature. Sister Esther, if you'd read. Next,
2:11.
In other words, 3 verses. 4 verses.
There was also another great eagle with great wings and many feathers. And behold, this vine did bend her roots toward him and shot forth her branches toward him, that he might water it by the furrows of her plantation. It was planted in good soil by great waters, that it might bring forth branches and that it might bear fruit, that it might be a goodly vine. Say thou, thus saith the Lord God, shall it prosper? Shall he not pull up the roots thereof and cut off the fruit thereof, that it wither? It shall wither in all the leaves of her spring, even without great power or many people to pluck it up by the roots thereof. Yea, behold, being planted, shall it prosper? Shall it not utterly wither? When the east wind toucheth it, it shall wither in the furrows where it grew. More on.
That's it. That's 10 verses. It's interesting to note that in the book of Ezekiel and a few other places in the Bible, such as Daniel, that very often it'll give you the setting of the whole parable. And we might like use our ingenuity as to what it represents, the parable. But actually, what happens in the next unit of space in the chapter, it tells you the explanation of what it means, of what the setting. It gives you the parable, and then after this, you want to know what the parable represents? It represents this. The only difference is this, that if you read the one and then read the explanation, you'll see what the other represents, but you'll lose a great deal of information that is not given, but being the key is given, then you have not really much of a problem understanding the detail, and that's the thing that I find is helpful to knowing basically what it's supposed to represent. Then go back and study it verse by verse, then read the explanation, and then you have a pretty good understanding that would stick with you. That's the main thing, that it sticks. Because very often you can read something that like is pretty understandable, and you get the lesson, and then 5 weeks later, you wouldn't know what it is. But this going through the detail is helpful going the second time. All right, now, in this, you'll notice that basically these are two illustrations, and one is said, this is an eagle, and it does such and such a thing, and it sprigs and seeds and so forth, and then this is another eagle that comes in the question. What is the first eagle?
Great wings, long wings,
yeah.
Rich in plumage and color.
For instance, that's the 12th verse of the next, say, see the 12th verse? The king of Babylon has come. All right, now, we're not going to read the explanation because in reading the explanation later, you're going to remember it better by first going through the detail. But the first eagle is the king of Babylon, the Nebuchadnezzar, yes. It happens to be that one by name, which we would find out either in the chapter itself or in the succeeding chapter. We've already had something about Nebuchadnezzar earlier. And then the second eagle is what? That does basic. It would be Egypt. It would be Egypt. So here's the picture. The first eagle has to do with the king of Babylon and what he did to Israel, and the king of Egypt and what he did to Israel. Now, the most important thing in understanding prophecy is to be very careful that you don't go out on a limb and go into great detail of explanation of the detail and then find out you've got on the wrong horse. And many do that from the platform. They'll read the prophecy, and they'll see it seems to fit along this line, and they'll give a whole discourse on it and so forth with joy and enthusiasm, and then find out it's wrong. And of course, it creates embarrassment. So that almost any question, any prophecy, you want to know which of one, two, three, or four roads is the right road. That's it. Whatsoever things are true. That's the main thing first. Then you go and study and use all the powers of mental concentration and desire and things like that in the direction or clue that's given. All right, now we go back. And here's this great eagle with great wings. Now, why? What would mean the great wings in this case? An eagle, a great eagle.
Very powerful.
All right, very powerful. That'd be one thing. Power. You could see, like, it's like a man with great muscles, big arms, big man, big. And also, it says another thing right after. No.
Long
wing. Uh-huh. Great wings and long wing. And now what's the long wing?
Overshadowing.
Yeah. All right, overshadowing a great
area
or territory, a big empire. A king, strong king with a strong centralized government and very, very extensive empire. It's like a universal empire, as it were. Very expensive. Now the next is full of feathers. Now what's the fullness of feathers have to do?
Good health.
Yes, it would be
good health.
All right. A very extensive empire, a very rich, lucrative realm, and maybe covering many peoples. A great amount of people. And what's the next thing?
Diverse colors.
And this would represent?
Different races.
Now see, the thing is, in going through this, just reading it and then giving an explanation, you lose a great deal of the power of the vision that the Lord takes the time to tell you a powerful eagle, a long, extensive domain, and in that domain, great riches, and wealth and diversity of peoples, all under the parable of an eagle. Now, what's this?
Came unto Lebanon.
All right. Came unto.
Yeah.
And took the highest branch of the cedar.
Power.
All right. Now.
Well, Lebanon, where all the seed is grown.
The Lord said Nebuchadnezzar would be.
All right.
Everything would rest under his branches. Manasseh was cut down.
Where is Lebanon?
North of Israel.
And when the king of Babylon came, I don't know if we had in this study, we have had it a couple times. I don't know if it's in this class. But it was his custom, the king, to not himself go directly into the battle, King Nebuchadnezzar, but he sent his captain. Remember his name, captain's name? Nebuzaradan, I think it was. Nebuzaradan, the captain. And he would have the captain do the work. But he took credit for it because he generally, he would give the instructions, what he would want done, how it should be done, what general motive, motive he had in mind. For instance, that has a lot to do when a man goes out with the forces, the field general, and the field general's going to do the fighting. He wants to know what he can do and what he cannot do, and what the president or whoever sends him out, what his ultimate objective is. And so that's what, so the king is, Nebuchadnezzar gets the credit, even though he may not be on the very front soldier in the line. So it was his practice in going down and capturing Israel that where would they stop?
In Lebanon.
In Lebanon, and right at the border of the land. In fact, there's even the name of the town given in another case. This is very difficult. I'm just doing it on the hope that somebody might remember something. There's a little place called Ribla, which is on, it's like a little town on the border, and that's where the king would come normally whenever he's coming to Canaan. To do any fighting in Canaan, that would be his headquarters or camp, because it was a suitable staging area, and then he would send it out. And in one prophecy, I think it was here, where he was debating whether to go down and fight Ammon, the capital of the Ammonites, or to go to Jerusalem. And the Lord wanted him to go to Jerusalem, but he was so determined to go to Ammon. And so he didn't want to really go to Jerusalem. It was just a hypothetical thing, but he was really wanted to go to Ammon. So he wanted to consult the spirits and necromancy and so forth. And everything he did, the Lord made sure, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And he wouldn't go, and he wouldn't go three times. And finally, the thing that decided him for him to go down and fight Israel was what? A man said to him, "They are a rebellious people. They're stiff-necked. Remember what they used to do? They broke their word and so forth. I'll do it." That's it. That was the thing that swayed him, and he went down to Jerusalem. So the Lord said he would be the one that makes sure that the king would go down and visit judgment on Jerusalem first, which he did.
Isn't it like at the end of the age, too? God
very good. Very good. Now, who was so that?
Came about. Huh?
That's right. With hooks in the nose. Right. Very good. Very good answer. Because that's we have to study the picture. That's why I'm taking more time here, and I sometimes overlook the other. Because if you get this, you can of your own sense self see later that propriety and the same thing is sort of taking shape today. And the Lord uses very similar methods in connection with his objectives. Now this cropping off, taking of the highest branch of the seed, the top of the young twigs, and carrying it into the land of traffic, what would that be?
Sounds like young people.
Alright, that would be
like the young Hebrew boys who have taken.
All right, that would be very good. That's right.
The cream of the crop.
The cream of the crop. And the highest branch. It's like saying the princes of the land. The intellectuals would be one class, of which like Daniel was. Another class might be the priestly class. Some of the, say the son of the priest, or the one who would be next. Take of the intellectuals, take of the prince. The royal family and the priesthood, and then possibly the tradespeople. People who have special abilities in armor wear or metal plating or something like that. And that would be skimming the surface off. And by taking the young ones, they would also serve another purpose. If you select the highest quality, and they would also serve not only to enrich the empire, but would serve another purpose of being hostages. They would be hostages. Because if they broke the covenant, he could always threaten to kill the king's son, for instance. Yeah, he doesn't say he's going to do it, and he didn't do it in this case, but it's a threat, so it serves a double purpose of enriching the captor himself, and also it would serve notice that what might happen if they didn't behave themselves. Now, when did this happen? This is very difficult, this subject, and it takes several years, and unfortunately we don't have studies of this. No. Now, this is not 606 yet, because in 606 that comes a little later chapter, for one thing.
That's when they came in and took the spoils out of the took the temple.
They took some of the treasury, and they also took who captive? Daniel was one. Who was another?
Three boys.
Three Hebrew children, and another.
Meshach and Abednego.
All right, that's the name of them. That's going even further. And Ezekiel. Ezekiel. And then it tells about some of the nobility. The princely line and so forth. That's in the account. And you don't have the whole thing spelled out in Ezekiel, but some of it's in Ezekiel, some of it's in Jeremiah, and some of it's in the book of Chronicles, and some in the book of Kings. And this would be 11 years prior to 606. Mm-hmm. And remember, this book started in the fifth year of the Jeconiah captivity, which means 5 years after this event happened, of the taking of this top grace, that's when the king of Babylon came down and took captive Bad Daniel and others, and went and took them to his land. Now, what happens in the interim period? We'll find that we have to finish this first setting about the first eagle first before we jump to the other. And he carries it into a land of traffic and set it in the city of merchants. And what's the city of traffic?
Babylon.
Okay, and this would be like the center of activity too. And he shows that he's going to exploit these captives, and he did. Look at Daniel. Daniel was elevated to be like prime minister. He was the top of three top men. He had three prime ministers, and of the three, Daniel was chief. And then Daniel was not only the chief of the prime minister, he was the chief of the college of the Magi, of the wise men as well. And then of the province, Babylon was divided into three major areas. And of the three major areas, one was called Babylon itself. Like you have New York City, New York County, New York State. And then you have the United States. It so happens that New York is not the capital. New York City is not the capital of the nation. But in many other nations, the chief city is also the capital city. And so with Babylon, Babylon was both the capital as well as the biggest city. And in that city, you had the immediate metropolis, the suburbs, and like a county. And then you have a further area, the big province of the basic motherland. That would still be Babylon. Only a large area. Babylon the city, Babylon the county, Babylon the state, as it were. The state or... And then comes the empire, where you have the other governments that are subservient to and which enrich the land. So, this being into the midst of the land attracted would be like saying bringing right to the capital city, the biggest city, right in the center of all this activity in the heathen area. And the three Hebrew children were elevated. Who else was elevated in captivity, had a prominent position? It might be well to just consider. Daniel. Three Hebrew children. Now, somebody else in the later time.
Joseph.
Joseph would be one. And?
In Babylon?
Egypt.
Oh,
Egypt. Anybody?
No, not necessarily.
Anybody?
That's what some of those.
Yeah, but you see, what I mean is in the like administrative affairs, like Joseph was. See, Joseph was like right in the king's area, and Daniel was like a counselor to the king as well as prime minister. So you have there Daniel, Joseph, and the three Hebrew children were made governors of the province of Babylon itself. So they held very conspicuous areas underneath Daniel. So there'd be Daniel, the three under him, and then Lord.
Esther.
That's another. Queen Esther became the wife and the queen.
King.
Mordecai would be. He became like prime minister eventually after certain other experiences. And then another one who was in prophecy, very highly elevated, was about the decree of building the wall of the city later.
Nehemiah.
He was the cupbearer to the king. And the cupbearer was not just merely somebody who tasted for the poisonous drinks. Some people did that. They had to make sure every feast they'd had, they couldn't trust anybody, not even their own relatives. So when they had the food given him, this man had to eat a sample of the meat, a sample of the vegetables, and the drink, and he had to do everything. And he was sat at the king's table right there, and then the king knew he could go ahead and watch him, and if he doesn't get to show any bad effects, then he could go ahead and have a sumptuous repast. So, but that became eventually an honorable office, where it became more than just like a servant. A man who would have that honor became a counselor and a confidant of the king. So the king would select somebody who he felt he would gain a great deal from by having him as a right-hand man, and that man was Nehemiah, the cupbearer of the king. So here we see that being brought into the land of traffic, these young twigs, they fit in and were utilized by the king to enrich his empire. And they were Jews. These are all Jews.
Wouldn't this cause jealousy?
It certainly would cause jealousy.
It did, didn't it?
And when the king chose these, he didn't choose them because of their good looking or so, but because they were intelligent. They were unusual people. They were actually, he wasn't really thinking of having a Jew, but he wanted the best men, and sometimes they happened to be Jews. And in spite of the prejudice, like with Esther, eventually, in spite of the prejudice, because of what the Lord had done for them and all, they ended up in those high positions. Yes.
It was really the Lord who did the selecting. He made them the fairest and the fattest and
the wisest,
the most beautiful and all the time.
Well, that was had to do with the test. That, in connection with that beauty, was the one who was in charge of the diet. His neck was on the block, and he was a fellow. If they went on that plain diet and they started to look a little lean or so forth, he might have his head removed. And so in that case, by going on that simple fare, they were beautiful and healthy and all, then he could say, all right, you do what you please. You can go right ahead, and I won't interfere with your custom. But as far as getting into the empire part, that would be mostly prowess, some peculiar ability that they would possess. Let us take now this. It says, he took also of the seed of the land. Now, what's the seed of the land? And planted it in a fruitful field.
It's almost similar to the other, isn't it?
Yeah.
People.
It would show not only like the nobility from a political standpoint as hostages, but he would also select others of the land because of certain other abilities they might have, like Daniel, for instance. And Daniel was not a prince and all that to start with, but he had the ability, just like Joseph. Who was Joseph? He was hated of his brethren, and he was a dreamer. Joseph was a dreamer, but he ends up being prime minister of Egypt. And he had no training, except the Lord's training, and that was wisdom.
Like you said before, even like the tradesmen or skilled husbandmen that would work on vineyards and whatnot, which would be...
That's
the best
part.
Yeah.
So he had... the king was very shrewd in his selection. And it tells that this seed that was taken prospered and set it as a willow tree. Now, in setting it as a willow tree, where do you set a willow tree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. You set it in a very nice position because you want it to grow. You wouldn't put the willow tree in a dry area or in the sand or where there's rocky soil, but you make sure that there's some place where there's plentiful supply of water. So this seed, that being he particularly hand-picked it, as it were, he wanted to make sure that the seed would prosper, and so he made the arrangement that that particular seed or individual would be placed in a place where he had the ability and was given the circumstance and the amount of tools or money or whatever it might be in order to enrich the king. And it grew. See, that's the next verse, sixth verse. It grew and became a spreading vine of low stature. Now, this spreading vine of low stature would mean what? It shows two things.
Is it a vine? If it's pruned well, would not be growing up, maybe just.
Yeah. It's the type of beauty in it.
A servant.
Yes. All these, now notice, Daniel, while he was elevated to such a high position, he was very humble and he was very obedient to the king. And except where it interfered with him religious-wise, same with the three Hebrew children, they actually performed their tasks and did a very good job of it. But while they were kept in low stature, nevertheless, it spread their influence, spread. And so they had a great deal of power in the empire, but the branches were turned toward the king. That is, they were loyal. They were loyal subjects in captivity, those that recognized God's providence in this particular arrangement. The only thing is, now the danger is this, they should have realized that the Lord providentially did put them there, and that they should be content, just like Jeremiah said, go and build houses for 70 years, because you're going to stay there. Don't think you're going to come back next year, the year after, and settle there. But all these, like Daniel, of the faithful class, they were careful that this enrichment did not make them want to permanently settle in the land. It was well that they acquiesced to the Lord's providence, but Daniel prayed three times with his face towards Jerusalem. That would tell that his heart's desire was there. And even though the decree was given to go back, nevertheless Daniel didn't. Because he realized that God had put him in that place, but he did everything, you can bet that he did everything to facilitate the others going back. So in Zionist work, so many say, everybody can go back if they're loyal. Not necessarily. Some people, they are more influential in the position where they are, but their heart and work and dedication should be, if they're, I'm just speaking now from a natural standpoint, should be, well, if we're here and we have a position, a great honor and so forth, and going back here we might lose everything, the wise thing then would to do would to sink funds in the land and try to encourage others and to think of your own children possibly going back and settling there. If you can't, maybe they can. And this would be the motive, and that would be the proper attitude. One, of realizing the situation. Not be too radical and just jumping to certain conclusions, just all embrace it. Some did succumbed in their prosperity. They then began to lose interest in going back. And that's why only 53,000 went back, and maybe as many or more stayed. That then became a test 70 years later. I'm just speaking in general terms. Whether they really was a temporary or tabernacle in condition. Now we're back here. The roots under him so became a vine, brought forth branches, and shot forth sprigs. Now this shooting forth sprigs, putting forth branches and sprigs, proves that it was a spreading vine, for one thing, but even their children and their children's children seemed to get into a prosperous or a comfortable position. So it wasn't just themselves. They prospered, their seed prospered, and their seed's seed prospered in the land. So what happened? This was a growing thing, and all these young buds coming out, it was new, showing that it began to, no wonder they began to behave, see, from a certain standpoint, as an alien force. I like to think, I think a lot could be said and shown about Daniel in the kingdom that's not in the Bible, and I think there's going to be tremendous what that man has done, Daniel, the beloved of the Lord, that we get clues as to what it might be.
Do you think he helped to expand to acclimate to this land and to be content. He was a leader, probably.
He would tell him, listen to Jeremiah's advice. And he also, when that period ended, he says, the 70 years are elapsed. When he realized the 70 years elapsed, he knew then, here's the crucial period. Now there's no longer that, can't we go back? And he prayed God. And you can bet, I hate to use the bug expression, I would say Mr. Booth, but I bet he put a bug in the king's ear, Cyrus's ear, about issuing that decree by calling his attention to Isaiah. He says, you know your name is in the Bible? That you, before you were born, 150 years before you even were born, our God, the God of the Hebrews, has said that you were going to issue a decree to build the city of Jerusalem and the temple thereof. See? But what happened, that the temple part, the city there, was a picture of Christ. The Cyrus, the Christ, building both the city and the temple, but the king did go ahead with the temple part, and he acquiesced, and he issued this decree. And while he allowed others to go back, I believe the Jew was the first. As far as we have the evidence, he's the first one, and he thought, well, that'd be a good idea. This generous, magnanimous attitude would make a prosperous empire, which he shouldn't be too fearful. Now that's the first setting, the first six verses. The king of Babylon and what he did and the captivity, the Jeconiah captivity and what he brought back, and that this seed prospered, which was primarily of Judah. Incidentally, we're reading the book of Ezekiel. There were other captives that had been taken earlier by the king of Syria by the 10-tribe king. In the days of Hosea the prophet and Hezekiah, just using round terms, when the king Hezekiah, a century before, was king, the 10-tribe kingdom was taken into captivity. Now, in issuing this parable about the eagle, which is the king of Babylon, it's worded in a way that the 10-tribe kingdom can take a lesson from this, as well as the tribe of Judah, like Daniel and those who were taken captive, that the lesson not only applied to them, but they would think, could that be that the king of Syria, that when he took us captive, those that were with Ezekiel, that he's talking to us, and the Lord is talking to us, by sort of allowing them to give that liberal, a broader application to this thing, which would be proper, because the principles would apply. And so he brings in this about Lebanon, and that's why I think he brings that about Lebanon in, because they would think of it, well, maybe he means the king of Syria, because Lebanon is closer to Syria. But actually, the king of Babylon went to Lebanon, and he went to Riblah, and that's where he made his headquarters, and that's what it's primarily referring to. But it does suggest the other, which would be a helpful lesson, so that all the captives in captivity, the 10-tribe kingdom and those of Daniel and those of Judah that had been previously taken to captivity as a sampling post, that they all would get the lesson of this particular first eagle. So we've taken a lot of time to go into the background. The helpful part, you will see that when you read these other passages in not this chapter only, but when you read Jeremiah and Chronicles, there are certain things will then, and you'll say, oh yes, there's an association. And even the eagle is brought up again. Incidentally, not only was the king of Babylon likened to an eagle, he was likened to something else. This is like taking what we learn in truth and trying to carry it with us as far as other.
He was likened to that tree.
He was likened to a tree, in one case, where there was with it. All right, that's one.
The image.
The image, all right. But what?
The head.
The head of the image, all right. And one other part. There's actually two more, but one more would be more. He was likened to a lion. With the beasts, when he had the beasts, the lion, with eagle's wings. So it combines the single eagle with, in another prophecy in Jeremiah, where he's called a lion. And then in the prophecy of Daniel, he's called the lion with eagle's wings. Combines the lion and the eagle as being Nebuchadnezzar. We're just mentioning this, that that there is an association, so that when you read that about the lion and you think of this here, there's so close a picture that one throws light on the other. Now we come to the next one. The second eagle. Another great eagle. And that was who?
Egypt.
And then it says it had
great wings.
Great wings. That's strength. It doesn't go quite into as much detail as the other. And it was a big empire, but it was not as extensive. It certainly was. It didn't embrace the nations of the first eagle. Right? Here's the first eagle. It has had a very large empire, but the Egyptian, while it was a very powerful, it was a rival empire, and it would, the rival was very, very strong, but its peoples would embrace more, those of what place or area? Mostly? Well, that would be in part, but in, yes, that would be part, but not as much the lucrative, but Sudan, Libya, Ethiopia, the African continent. So Egypt was entrenched in the Nile and all surrounding nations of the Nile in that continent, and it was pretty rich, wealthy, and extensive. But the king of Babylon, he was in the more civilized part, generally speaking, where there were all these mixed peoples, Hindu, Chinese, and other area background. In the second eagle, the same policy, it was planted in the good soil by great waters. He might water it by furrows of her plantation. Now this suggests what?
Sounds like the Nile, but it's
That's right, it does. That's the way they ran the water off the Nile into these ditches, and they became like tributary furrows. And it says that that land was so rich that you could do something with the seed. You could, throw the seed and water it with your foot, and it would just take root. It was so rich, the soil. Mm. And that you could, the simplest tools would yield tremendous results because of the fertility of that soil. In Babylon, that was mostly a mercantile power, where they were strong militarily and had a big empire, but he had a lot to do with boats and navies and things like that. Babylon was a mercantile power, even though the capital was pretty far inland. They went up the river Euphrates, but it had access out to the seas. Nile, even though it had a nice Nile mouth and all, Egypt was not known as a mercantile nation, generally speaking. That it's kept to itself. And it planted good soil. Now this good soil is the what called? This is one of the very things that Egypt was noted for, the soil, its soil. That each year the Nile overflowed the banks and deposited this black loam from Ethiopia and the land, took all the rich soil from the forest lands of the inland part of Africa and brought this down and scattered it around. And they didn't have to keep fertilizing. Most times when you go to a place, you have so much clay in your soil and it's so rocky and barren that you have to feed it food. You have to keep feeding it in order to get fruitful results. But here in Egypt, it was already came down fertilized and already rich. And each year was deposited this sediment. And then that would go layer upon layer upon layer. So it was very... So you can see that in reading here that historically and physically and a lot of other things, there's very appropriate language used. And here it was fruitful even in Egypt. We could go into this, but I don't want to take time on that. Maybe some other day we have to give a talk or two on this to go into the history of Egypt, which is so new that it's in the Bible too, but it's so scattered that I don't think we could do it at this time. The lesson would be lost because it's getting too broad. But the history of Babylon and these nations is better known, because when we go to school, we know a little more about the peoples of the Middle East and Europe than we do about Africa and Egypt. And it did the same thing in these curves. Now, with this introduction, let us now read the Lord's answer to the parable that he had set up. Samuel, would you read 4 verses, and Bonnie, 4 more verses, and that would cover 8 verses. Starting with 11, 4 verses each.
Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, say now to the rebellious house, know ye not what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon is come to Jerusalem, and hath taken the king thereof, and the princes thereof, and led them with him to Babylon, and hath taken of the king's seed, and made a covenant with him, and hath taken an oath of him. He hath also taken the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be base, that it might not lift itself up, but that by keeping of his covenant it might stand.
But he rebelled against him in sending his ambassadors to Egypt, that they might give him horses to much people. Shall he prosper? Shall he escape that doeth such things? Or shall he break the covenant and be delivered? As I live, said the Lord God, surely in the place where the king dwelleth, that made him king, oh, he despised, and whose covenant he break, even with him in the midst of Babylon he shall die.
All right. Now, with all the explanation we've given, this is much more necessary when we have the explanation. But at least now we have a tremendous wealth of history. That's it's tremendous. I think a lot of people waste time going to secular books when it's tremendous information here. We'll see some of it. The purpose of this says, know ye what these things mean. And then he gives the explanation. The king of Babylon is come to Jerusalem as past tense. And what year is this that Ezekiel is talking? We know it's certainly after the fifth year. It may be the sixth. Yeah, sixth. Eighth chapter. Read the eighth chapter, see? Oh, yeah, I feel the time is gone. All right. Thank you for coming. So, read, notice that, Sister Louise? Just read that first verse.
8:1?
Yeah, please.
This is revised. In the sixth year, in the sixth month of the fifth day of the month, as I sat in my house with the elders of Judah, sitting before me, the hand of the Lord God fell there upon me.
All right, now would you go back to the first chapter, the first verse, and that tells you what year it's talking about these things. In the second verse, first chapter, second verse.
On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans.
That'll be sufficient. Now the point that we want to say, this is the fifth year. The first chapter speaks of the fifth year of the captivity of the king. And when we go to the eighth chapter, it speaks of the sixth year of the captivity of that king. And now we come to the 17th chapter, and it's presumably about still the sixth year. And remember we had mentioned, I think it was in this class, that instead of thinking of the sixth year of Jehoiakim, to change it to something else, and it sticks in our mind much clearer. The sixth year of Zedekiah. Because when King Jehoiakim went into captivity, that's when Zedekiah was put on the throne. So the first year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the first year, the second year, third of Jehoiakim, is the same as the first, second, third of Zedekiah. And all Bible students know about Zedekiah, but they know very little about Jehoiakim because they don't study Ezekiel very much. So they know. But actually, by doing this, if this is the sixth year of Zedekiah's reign, what's going to happen in 606? What happened? What year was it? It was the... When was the city overthrown? Yeah. And what year was that of Zedekiah's reign? The 11th. That you go back to the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles, it tells you that in the 11th year, such and such a month, the city was destroyed and the temple. And so when now we, it's by taking this little extra time, that's kind of tiresome, but that little extra time makes it so it's like riveted in your mind. And then you're not going with a fuzzy, indefinite understanding, but you have something, you have an anchor, something you can hook onto. And so here we find in the sixth year of Zedekiah, only five more years, he's speaking that the king of Babylon previously is come. That was in the first year of the captivity, when he took King Jehoiakim in captivity 6 years earlier.
And he placed Zedekiah on the throne.
That's right. We're going to find that out in this chapter, right? That's exactly what we're leading up to. But this is in between. We're right in the middle point. 11 years. And in the middle, the sixth year, he says the king came earlier and took King Jehoiakim, took off the young twigs and all, took it into his empire. That had to do with Daniel and those. He's speaking backwards 5 or 6 years. And now forward 5 or 6 years, something else is going to happen. The same thing's going to happen here. Now we're down to the explanation, the Lord's explanation of the parable, the clues that are given. And we had considered the 11th and the 12th verse. And now the 13th verse we'd like to, and hath taken of the king's seed and made a covenant with him. Now who was, and hath taken of the king's seed, which king?
King of Israel.
All right, the king of Israel, that's right. And even if you put...
Which king is it?
All right, that's where we're going to go. Josiah was the king that was near the end of the age when he had children. And Zedekiah was related to him. Jeconiah, Jehoahaz, they're all related as son or grandson or brother, things like that. I view this, that it's speaking about as though in the land of Israel itself, that king, his seed, and who was that? One of Josiah's children was Jeconiah. Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah is another name for the same person, was of the king's seed. After the king had died, though. See, the king had died, Josiah, and then his successor was a Jehoahaz who reigned 1 month. Was it 1 month or 3 months? One of them reigned only 1 month. One reigned 3 months and a certain amount of days. And so we don't have it in our chronology, this. That's another reason why we have a little problem with this part of history. Not only do we not study the book of Ezekiel, we're not familiar with these kings with the Jeconiah, Jehoiakim, and all these, because they reigned such a short... Well, Jehoiakim reigned a long time, so that's another matter. But Jehoiakim and has, no. And yet they're in the prophecy and occupy a considerable space of time, place.
Jehoiakim has another name, hasn't he?
Jehoiakim is Eliakim. Eliakim. All right, good. Let's go back. I said, well, what do you say we go back to Book of Kings and so forth and look at there? That'll help so that when you go home, you'll get have a reference.
We used to have a big sheet.
Well, that's the sheet. You forget. It's like a crutch. Mm-hmm. You forget. Right. Where if you fasten it in the Bible, then you can always turn back to that account. So there's two ways to go. We can go right like the end of the book of Chronicles or the end of the book of Kings, because that's where they're ending up.
So which one do you want now?
I'm going to take Chronicles now. I might as well see. Yeah, see how it's here. Just go to Josiah, 34th chapter. Of Chronicles, Second Chronicles. And the end of the second book of Kings would talk about the same thing. But what happens in one book, it tells you one little clue. The other book, it tells you. We're just using one of them. Now here it talks about Josiah. He was 8 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned in Jerusalem 131 years. Actually, I think he was 18.
Instead of 8?
And then 8. I think if you go back to Kings.
8 is kind of young, isn't it?
Yeah, let's go back to 2 Kings 22. See in the margin?
Yeah.
See that A, Josiah A? Look in the margin. I'm just taking a little time out to show how to look up. See, it says 2 Kings 22, 3. So you go back to 2 Kings 22, 3. They're not always right, but very often, 90% of the time. Now, 22:3. It came to pass in the 18th year. See? See the difference?
Yeah.
See, I happen to know this because I've studied a lot.
The
8th
had a terrible young to be reigning.
Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 31.
But he actually was 18.
But the first verse is Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign.
I know he does. And Chronicles differs with Kings because Chronicles...
Kings 32. 22:1.
The same thing. 22:1, Josiah was 8.
Isn't that
22:1? Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is the 18th. Oh, I see. All right, that's the 18th year. No, this isn't the king. There are two kings in Israel where the account in Kings is different than the one in Chronicles. And the one you take is the one that's older.
Well,
what about in the 18th year of King Josiah in 3? That's 18 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, what Frank said.
I'm not coming to there yet. But keep that open because in Chronicles it may not be. I just mentioned that, but I was wrong on that point. But there are kings where there is a mistake of a unit of 10 or 100.
There's a revising on what it says. There's in one verse it says 31 years, and the other one says 130 years in the other chapter in Chronicles.
Well, that's chiefly because when they had translators, no translator did all the Old Testament like today. The translators today, they'll do the whole Old Testament, the whole New Testament, call it Goodspeed, Moffat, or some other man who does the Bible. Back there, they never did that. The king appointed a man to each book. So when one wrote on one book and translated the first book of Kings or the second book of Kings, he used his own little language. It's essentially the same thing, but he used his own terminology. And so you'll find these differences. And that accounts a lot for the spelling of words, too.
Yeah.
The consonants are the same, but the vowels, one translator will put an A instead of an E or an I or an O or a U. And that's where you get all your variances. The New Testament differs with the Old Testament. But not the constants. The constants are the same.
This one,
yeah, we're coming to him too. You just keep your thumb there, Charles. That's what I want to come to. But I want us to go back to the root. See, to Josiah. Notice when he dies. Now you run down this chapter to where he dies.
Where are we going?
Josiah. The 34th chapter tells where he begins to reign. Now you keep going and you'll notice Josiah keeps the Passover. And you go a little, he's slain at Megiddo, right? That's 2 Chronicles 35. And then it goes down to the end of that 26th, now the rest of the acts of Josiah, so, and his deed. Now the 36th chapter. Then the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and made him king in his father's stead in Jerusalem. And he was 23 when he began to reign. And he reigned 3 months. And then the king of Egypt condemned him in the land. So when the king made his brother Eliakim king over Judah and Jerusalem, and turned his name to Jehoiakim. This has to do with this part. And then the king of Babylon came up and took. Let's see, down the 9th verse. Here's one. Jehoiakim was 8 years old when he began. This is the one that probably was the 18th. When he began to reign. Let's see. Q. Maybe Q. I can't even find it. The Psalms. No, that would be it. I can't find the cross references folder here on that one. Or is that a G?
Jeremiah.
That may be a G. 2 Kings 24:8. Just for interest, 2 Kings 24:8. That's what you had your thumb in, Charles.
Yeah, here it says
18.
See? Is that right?
Yeah. See? 18. See? Jehoiakim, Chenkin, was 18 years old when he reigned.
Yeah.
And now when you go to Chronicles, it was 8. I just brought this up as an illustration that this mistake of 100 years that Brother Russell's made, that he could be right, Brother Russell, because we have a precedent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always like it says out of the mouth of two or three witnesses, even in the mistake, this is like put in there to show that that possibly could happen with the unit of it, with a decimal unit, like you put a decimal in the wrong place.
Yeah.
All right, now back to Joy. Eliakim was put on the throne. But notice that Jehoahaz was of the seed of Josiah. That's the 36th chapter, the first verse. He was one of his sons. Now we go back the fourth verse. It says the king of Egypt made Eliakim his brother. Well, then that meant that Eliakim or Jehoiakim, because he changed his name to Jehoiakim, he was also a son of Josiah. Right? Now when you go back to the parable, and it tells that in Egypt, in Ezekiel, that he took of the king's seed, that Josiah was, it's his children that are involved in this. And actually there are around three involved. One has to do with an uncle, which is Zedekiah, which we'll come to. Now let's go down to the where Zedekiah is put on the throne. See, ninth verse, Jehoiakim, and he reigned 3 months, and so, and then he was taken by the king of Babylon into captivity. Notice? The ninth verse of the 36th chapter. And the 10th verse says, and when the year was expired, the king of Babylon took the goodly vessels of the house of the Lord, and I'm paraphrasing, and made Zedekiah his brother king over Judah and Jerusalem. Now you have, to start with, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim with an N, and they're all spoken of as brothers. Actually, though, this term brother is used in a loose sense because Mattaniah or Zedekiah, which is what it's saying here, Zedekiah, Mattaniah, that's another name for him, that he was not a direct brother, son. There was another relationship of an uncle. I think that has to do with a brother's son. Isn't that, for instance, if you say your uncle, I have to do this slow because I'm not as adept at this. When you speak of your uncle, that would be your father's brother. Which would be the father's son, but on another line, on another tangent. And there is a relationship, but that father is the thing that's common to them both, which is Josiah. And in the Bible, it sometimes uses the word brother to give this relationship, not necessarily meaning a direct relationship in the immediacy sense, but in this other sense of with a brother involved.
Then your brother, I think he's brother.
Not necessarily. So you have to get the context. Now, we would not know here, except from other scriptures that I'm aware of, where when you take them all together, you find out that two of these are direct sons, and the other one has to do with a brother. Now we come to, that was Zedekiah. Now notice here, there was Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah. Three. But this prophecy of Ezekiel, we're only talking about two. But now, it isn't Jehoahaz, because that's the king of Egypt first. This parable starts with the king of Babylon first, and then Egypt. So it's coming down to the last two. Have taken of the king's seed and made a covenant with him. Now when Josiah died, the king of Egypt took Jehoahaz, but the king of Babylon took Jehoiakim, another son of the seed, and made a covenant with him, and had taken an oath of him, and also taken the mighty of the land. Now, let's look at this brother. Let's go back to 2
Kings. What number are we on again?
Ezekiel 17th chapter, 13th verse. Now, we want to make it about this covenant.
2 Kings what?
Charles, you have it. 2 Kings 24, was it?
22.
Where it mentions about the covenant.
422?
I don't know about the covenant.
Yeah, 27. Yeah, here's about Mattaniah, too. See the 17th verse? This king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead.
You want to hear this revised?
Yeah.
And the king of Babylon made Mattaniah Jehoiakim's uncle.
Yeah, see, that's, I mentioned about the uncle. See, it's another way of saying
king in his stead.
That's
changed his name to Zedekiah.
That's combining this other scripture that's in, one's in Jeremiah, one's in the book of Chronicles, where it analyzes it and then gives you the fruit of the analyzed. But it's based on, it's not the son in the sense that you might get from reading only a small, narrow portion. But going back, he made a covenant with the, even this one here, of Babylon. So the king of Babylon made Mattaniah his father's brother in his kingdom. Where is it mentioned the covenant? There's a place where it tells actually making the covenant. Maybe it's in the Chronicles. In fact, there should be a few places. I just wanted to find one of them. To show which covenant was broken with the king of Babylon. Maybe the next lesson, the Lord willing, we'll have a blackboard and we'll go into this. Because it's very hard to explain it orally, because there's two covenants made. One was made with Jehoiakim, one was made with Zedekiah. And I wanted to find them, but I just don't find them at this minute. Okay, let's go back to the 17th chapter of Ezekiel. And had taken of the king's seed and made a covenant with him, and had taken an oath of him. Now, and had taken the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be based, not might lift itself up, but by the keeping of his covenant might stand. Now this is taking hostages. By taking hostages, the king of Babylon was doing, accomplishing two things. But he rebelled against him in sending ambassadors into Egypt. Now, who sent the ambassadors into Egypt? The king of Israel, the king in the homeland, yes. He made a covenant orally with the king of Babylon, but actually he was on the side, secretly, he was conniving with the king of Egypt, how he might break this bondage to Babylon. And that's the second eagle is involved in this picture of Egypt. And then how that, because of this secret agreement, breaking the covenant with the king of Babylon, that the Lord would punish them. But he rebelled against him in sending his ambassadors into Egypt that they might give him horses and much people. Well, why would they want to give the king of Israel much horses and people?
Well, then Egypt would go in there and take her over, maybe, and she would be on top and be the world power. Hmm, well, that's
good.
Succeed.
We in history they teach that the third power that's in, there's two great powers, and the one that's in the buffer zone has the advantage, though it's a little weak power, of conniving against getting the best. It's like some nations, they'll cater to Russia and they cater to America, and they say, if you don't do so and so, we'll go to him, and then secretly they go to the other one and they say, if you don't do so, in the meantime they get revenues from both. And they have they're protected by both, because if this one comes in and makes them invade, they have an engagement. This one's going to fight for them, and then the other one will fight for them. And so they're playing both ends to the middle, and where they'll survive, just even though they're a weak power in between. Well, Israel was the king had been taken captive. His son was taken into captivity, watched with the goods of the temple and so forth. And here they have hostages here. In the meantime, he's conniving with the king of Egypt for military supplies and help and an agreement to protection against Babylon. But the Lord had told the prophets near the end of the age there that they should go into Babylon captivity peacefully, quietly, recognizing it's the Lord's will. But they were doing everything else, not exercising faith, trying to forestall that day. But shall it prosper? Shall he escape that doeth such things? Shall he break the covenant, be delivered? As I live, saith the Lord, surely in the place where the king dwelleth that made him king, whose oath he despised, whose covenant he brake, even him in the midst of Babylon, he shall die. Now, who died in the midst of Babylon? Zedekiah. That's what it's talking about, Zedekiah. Mm-hmm. Now, one prophecy says he wouldn't see the land of Babylon. And this one says he's going to die there. It seems to be a contradiction. It wasn't because his eyes were put out. His eyes were put out at Riblah, and his sons were slain, and then he was taken captive into Babylon and was blind. So both prophecies are fulfilled. And it says, now there are two kings in Babylon. King Zedekiah and King Jeconiah. And in the 37th year of the king of Nebuchadnezzar, it says in the 37th year, he lifted up the head of Jeconiah and had him eat at his table. So he had been 37 years in exile. This is long after the city is destroyed, because the city was destroyed in the 11th year of exile. But in the 37th year, Evil-Merodach, when he became king of Babylon, he lifted up the head of Jeconiah. Now, presumably, then Zedekiah had died. In that
Zedekiah did see his sons killed.
Yes, he saw him at the border of the land. They were slain before him, and then his own eyes were put out, and he was taken captive, and then there are two kings in exile. Where are, what verse?
About 16.
Now, there's this covenant that was made with the two kings, but particularly the one with Zedekiah that I was looking for. Can't find it. But it's you could do that as homework. Where the king of Babylon made a covenant with Zedekiah, and which covenant Zedekiah broke, therefore Zedekiah is going to be taken into Babylon today. Now, we won't be able to finish this chapter. That's for sure. I'm just trying to pace myself. We'll read just two verses more. Sister Edna.
17 and 18?
Yes.
Neither shall Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company make for him in the war, by casting up mounds and building forts to cut off many persons, seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant. When, lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape.
Now this has to do with Zedekiah, and that the king of Egypt would be of no avail in helping him. In fact, the king of Egypt retreated before the forces of Nebuchadnezzar. He retreated into his land, and then he captured Israel, Judah, destroyed the city, and then he goes down into Egypt, and he took Egypt captive later, which Jeremiah speaks about more than Ezekiel. And this spreading of the net, the 20th verse, we had in an early chapter of Ezekiel, where Zedekiah was trying to slip out the back door. Remember when he took the household furniture and home and said, "What are you doing, Ezekiel?" And he says he was acting out the king that was in Israel, how he would be captured. At nighttime, he thought he'd sneak out of the city by that gate that you mentioned, the hole in the wall. And he would be captured. And this is saying, "I'll take him in the net," and that refers to a very early chapter of Ezekiel, 8th or 9th or 10th chapter, somewhere in there. So each little picture overlaps the other, supplies further information. We won't be able to finish this except to say that we identified the first two evils, King of Babylon and the one great other great power was the King of Egypt, and then the story is about the punishment to be visited on Israel in its relations or negotiations between the two great powers. Let us close without a word, without a hymn. And Brother August.
Loving Father, we are thankful to Thee for this privilege we've had this morning to assemble ourselves together to study more of Thy Word. We are thankful to Thee of the depths of this wonderful book, the Bible, and that we are able to dig into it and appreciate these depths and the wonders of Thy plans and purposes. We do love Thee, dear Lord, and want to please Thee in all things, and to try and prove all things that are in this Thy Word. We thank Thee for the privilege of gathering together. I ask blessings upon all Thy dear ones. We ask forgiveness of our shortcomings. And also ask a blessing on our noonday meal, and thank Thee for it. In Jesus' precious name, amen.